everyone, and welcome to episode 61 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. Now, a lot of people have been asking me questions about peasants lately, so I thought I would talk about peasants today just a little bit. And I have to say that learning about people's everyday lives is what really got me interested in the Middle Ages, past the sort of Arthurian stories that I had been reading in the beginning. So I'm with you. I also really like the stuff that's about ordinary people and ordinary lives. So today we're going to talk a little bit about peasants, and we're going to talk about 5 myths that people still have about peasants that happened to make me crazy. So this is probably going to turn into one of my rants, so buckle up. But let's talk a little bit about peasants, 5 myths that people still have about peasants. Okay, so when we're talking about peasants, we are really talking about serfs for the most part. When people use the word peasant, they generally mean serfs. So these are the people that were tied to the land. Now, they weren't slaves. They did have slavery in Europe in the Middle Ages, especially during the early part of the Middle Ages, but that sort of fell by the wayside. Terry Jones talks about this in Medieval Lives, his book and his series, in that slavery, if you have a slave, this means that you have to take care of the slave, which can be a difficult thing to do. I was talking to kids on a YouTube video about armies, and with an army, it's the same thing in the Middle Ages. If you had a standing army, that means you had to feed them and house them. Well, it's the same with slavery. So to feed and house a slave can be inconvenient for the people who own them. And again, I'm being a little sarcastic here. I definitely don't condone slavery. Hopefully you are noticing that as we go on. Definitely don't condone slavery. But if you're looking at it from kind of a master's point of view, to feed and house a slave is inconvenient. It's more convenient to make them work for you and also responsible for themselves. And so serfdom was really convenient for lords because the serfs were taking care of themselves. They were responsible for their own housing, their own food. But at the same time, they also worked the lord's land, and they also gave him rent and respect. He was the person who was in charge of them to a certain point. So this was more convenient for the lord. And over time, there were more freemen than there were serfs. But during a large part of the Middle Ages, there were a lot of serfs. In England, they were called villeins. Yes, this is the origin of the word villain that we know today. The fact that we call the bad guy a villain today kind of tells you about who was telling the stories as time went on. And this word villain changed from meaning just a peasant to serf to the bad guy in a story. This relationship between a serf and a lord meant that the serf would work the lord's land, give him the produce from the land, rent as well, that kind of thing. And in exchange, the lord would be a good lord to them, would judge them fairly, would protect them in the event of an attack, and provide for them, make sure that they were taken care of. So a lord was in charge of a serf, had some control over their bodies and that they could punish them according to the law, but they didn't have full control over their bodies as in slavery. Things like prima nocta, that idea where a lord could sleep with a bride on the first night, that never existed. It wasn't legal. It wasn't a thing because the lord did not have that much control over his serfs. He only had bodily control of them to the extent of the law, and prima nocta was not a thing, just so we know. So that's just a little bit of background on serfdom, on peasants in the Middle Ages. So let's get into some of the myths here. The first myth that I want to address is the fact that people today think that medieval peasants were stupid. Now, this is something that comes to us from the early modern period, the Enlightenment, and, you know, the 20th century, 21st century. We like to think of ourselves as superior to the people that came before us because that makes us feel good. It makes us feel like we have made a lot of progress. But when it comes to intelligence, one of the ways that people seem to measure intelligence in terms of looking at the past is through literacy. So people are equating literacy and formal education with intelligence. And let me tell you how wrong that is. It's so, so wrong. To do that is to do a great disservice, not only to the people of the past, but to the people of the present. I mean, it's easier for people to be literate now because of technology. in the early modern period, people had the advantage of the printing press, which made it so that people could access the books that they needed more cheaply and on a wider scale. And we can see that definitely right now, more people can access more books and more teaching tools that help them to be literate. But just because we have more literacy now doesn't mean that we are more intelligent. Formal education is not equivalent to intelligence. And I want to say this very, very clearly, not only because I'm a medievalist, but because a lot of the people in my family have dyslexia. A lot of the teaching that I've done has been with people who have learning challenges or learning disabilities. A lot of the people that I love and admire most in this world are people who have trouble reading. The things that our education system really prizes, they struggle with. So it's really important to me that we look at this and we take apart the fact that literacy and intelligence are not the same thing. So the people today who struggle to read, how do they learn? They learn through podcasts, they learn through audiobooks, they learn through YouTube, they learn from seeing and listening and doing. And that's the same with medieval people as well. So if you're one of the people that's listening to this podcast, you're listening to my voice, you struggle to read, let me tell you something. I want you to hear it loud and clear. You are not stupid. You are an amazing person, and it has nothing to do with your intelligence if you struggle to read. You can learn all sorts of different ways, and you should be proud of that. And don't let anyone tell you that you're stupid, by the way. If they have a problem with you, you send them to me. I'll sort them out. So I do think that when people think of medieval peasants as being unintelligent, they're basing this kind of snobbery on the fact that a lot of medieval peasants were illiterate. And that's true. They were. A lot of medieval peasants were illiterate, but that doesn't mean they were stupid. Okay, I told you this is going to turn out to be a rant, but so many people that I care about struggle with literacy that I really need to make this point, and not just for the people of the past, but for the people today. Okay, so if you can't read in the Middle Ages, how do you learn things? Well, you learn things from speaking to people who might know more than you do about something. I mean, obviously we want to do this today. Speaking to a priest to find out more about the world is a great idea, because priests were people who had been formally educated. If you wanted to learn about what the current theories were about how the universe worked, how theology worked, you could speak to a priest. If you wanted to find out more about politics, you could speak to the messengers passing through town. You could speak to the steward who might have the ear of the Lord. You can speak to a servant in your Lord's household who might have overheard things. You could speak to the minstrels who came through town who have been playing at the royal court, perhaps, or at a local festival or at a market. You can talk to them and find out what was going on in the world. You could speak to an expert if you needed to do that. Lawyers, for example, or doctors, or people that had gone through, again, the formal education system, had learned. And by the way, most of them learned from listening, and they got their PhDs or their advanced degrees from doing oral exams. They weren't actually writing stuff down, and they weren't always reading either. So you could speak to them to find out more about the law or the things that you needed to know. Speaking to people, listening to people. Also, the type of learning that you needed to do in the Middle Ages was experiential. They had to pay attention to the tiniest details just to survive. I mean, we can go to the grocery store and we can assume that most of the food there is fine. There's nothing wrong with it. It's ripe. It's at the point that it's supposed to be when you eat it. Well, if you're a medieval peasant, everything you eat, you have to pay attention to see if it's ripe, to see if it's good, to see if it's something that you can eat. If you're in the forest, you need to be able to identify plants, for example. You need to pay attention to real fine details. Apprenticeship is something that was the way people learned, right? You learn things from your family. So if you had to feed yourself, you learn how to farm from your family. If you're a girl and you're learning how to take care of a household, you learn that from watching your family. You don't read books to do it. You learn by watching, by doing. And children were working during the Middle Ages, just as they do on farms today, or they do in your household today, where they learn by doing. So that's how people were learning. When it comes to medicine, experiential learning would have been really important because you could see whether something worked or not from experience, from seeing it being used in your village, for example. You might not know the reasons why it worked. Based on, in the Middle Ages, it was humoral theory, right? So people trying to balance their humors. If you want to learn about medieval medicine, listen to my podcast with Winston Black. They'll tell you all about the humors. But if you didn't know about the humors, you would still know if something worked or not. And humoral theory right now has been, well, pretty much debunked. But a lot of the herbal medicine that has been used, that people saw being used, that they used on each other and on themselves, that stuff has lasted because people observed how it worked. It wasn't necessarily based on a grand theory that you'd find in a textbook, but it was based on experience. So the thing that I want to get across here, I'm not trying to disparage book learning. I mean, I love to read. It's one of my favorite things to do, but it's not the only kind of learning out there. And it's not necessarily the best kind of learning when you are faced with practical tasks, practical situations day in, day out, when it's part of your survival. So we cannot assume that medieval peasants were stupid just because they were mostly illiterate. Have I said this enough? I think I've said this enough. So we're going to move on. But that's the first thing I wanted to get across. And I did tell you it was going to be a rant. So I talked about people getting their news and information from people who had traveled. And this is another thing that people think is true about medieval peasants, that they never went anywhere, that they were kind of stuck on their farms and that they never moved from there. And that doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you look at it carefully. Now, if you were a serf, you did need to have permission from your lord if you're traveling somewhere that was outside of, you know, your normal routine. You did need to ask his permission. But that doesn't mean that it had to be difficult. I mean, if part of your job was that you needed to go to a market in a different parish, well, I mean, the lord is not going to get in your way because of that. So you did have to ask permission, but that didn't mean that you were stuck, that you were static, that you were stuck in this bubble under a dome or something like that. So why did people travel? Well, people traveled for pilgrimage very often. Pilgrimage didn't just mean going to Jerusalem, going to the holy sites in the Holy Land. That is a long way to go, and not a lot of people did that, relatively speaking. You know, a fair number did, but not a lot of people in relative terms. But there were a lot of holy sites that were a lot closer. Local saints had performed miracles as well. You'd have churches that were devoted to somebody who had performed a miracle nearby. So you would travel to a different village to ask for intercession, to ask for a miracle, to ask for something from a local saint. So people did travel for pilgrimage quite a lot. They traveled to ask for healing, to look for a good harvest, for fertility, for peace of mind, all the reasons that people pray now. People were praying for these things in the Middle Ages, and they would go to different saints to ask for this help. So people went on pilgrimage fairly often. They also went for trade reasons. So if you think about it, most people lived in small villages or hamlets, and there's only so much you can get. I mean, if you live in a small town now, there might be things that you find difficult to get because of where you're located, right? Same thing in the Middle Ages. If you lived in a small village or hamlet, it might be hard to get certain things. For example, you have a lord, he loves saffron, you happen to be the person who's cooking for him. Where do you get saffron? You might need to go get it in another village. Same thing if you are a person who is a peasant, you're working your farm, but after hours you like to carve spoons and you've carved amazing spoons and you get good money for these spoons, but you've sold one to everyone in the village already. What are you going to do from here? You're going to go sell them somewhere else. You could ask someone to sell them for you. You could go yourself. So people are going for trade reasons. There might be a bigger market in the next town, and you know, you need to go and get things that you need there, or sell things that you have if you've already saturated your own market. So people are traveling for trade as well. People are traveling for jobs too. How many blacksmiths does a village need? Well, it's good to have a few of them, but if you have too many of them, then the blacksmith, one of them, has to move. And they did that too. So you could go and move for a different job. Lots of people who were peasants worked as servants in different households. And if you didn't have an opportunity to do that in your village, you could see if there was one in the next village as well. So there were reasons to travel for jobs too. Travel was not an easy thing for peasants. If you couldn't afford a horse, for example, it takes a long time. Outlaws might be in the woods. It's not an easy thing to travel. If you don't have a place to stay and the journey takes a few days, you know, it's hard. You might have to sleep rough. But that doesn't mean that people didn't travel. They did. One of the other reasons that people might travel, and this is bringing me to my third myth here, is for marriage. People tend to think that all marriages in the Middle Ages were horrible. They were all arranged and nobody had any say in the matter. First of all, let me direct you to the episode I did with Ruth Mazo-Karas, who talks all about marriage, and she's just fantastic. So do listen to that one. But in a nutshell, peasants could have an easier time marrying somebody that they loved than a noble would have. So it's a lot easier if you're a peasant to marry somebody that you love, because there wasn't as much at stake, right? You didn't have a huge amount of land and responsibility to worry about, so you didn't have to make a match based on that. You didn't have to make a match based on certain bloodlines either. You had a bit more freedom in that way. And I'm talking about traveling. You might have to travel outside of your village to find somebody eligible or suitable, because if you live in a small village, well, there might not be that many available people, especially if you have families that are having lots of kids and you are the last kid to get married. I mean, you might have to go to another parish, another village to find somebody to marry. So people were traveling for marriage and they did have more say in their marriage than nobles did. So if you're looking for someone to get married to, there's nobody suitable in your village, you might need to ask your networks, your social networks, ask your relative, ask the traveling priest, ask somebody that's a business associate, somebody who's been back and forth from village to village. They might know somebody that you could marry. It could be somebody that you met through work as well. I mentioned that young people often were servants, or they were workers that were hired out to other people. So you could meet someone at work that you fell for. So there were choices to have. Now, Ruth Mazo-Karas will tell you this as well in the podcast on marriage, but the most important thing that you needed to have for a marriage to be valid was consent. And I think this is a surprise for a lot of people, especially when they think of marriage as being unhappy or arranged. You needed to have consent in order for a marriage to be legal. So that doesn't mean that people didn't shove other people into marriages. But if the church found out that a marriage was undertaken under duress, that people were forced into it, it wouldn't be legal. So in order to avoid the legal headache and the heartache, I do say this in my book as well, to avoid the heartache of having people in a bad marriage or having them disagree at the altar, it helped to have people marry someone that they liked, hopefully that they loved. And another thing that made it easier for peasants to marry is that they could wait. They could afford to wait. So peasants married often in their late teens or early 20s. Nobles married in their earlier teens, especially if they were girls, around 12, 13, depending on where they were. But peasants could be teenagers who were serving in somebody's house, and they could just keep working and save up money because there was no time limit on it. They didn't have to get married right away because there were no things like big lands that were involved. You did have to have consent, but you didn't have to have a priest or anything like that. If you said the right words, "I will take you as my husband, I will take you as my wife," then you were married. So it was easier for peasants to marry for love as well, because they didn't need to have a priest. They could just make this vow behind a haystack. And this could mean, we talked about this in that podcast as well, could mean that people were accidentally married. It could mean that they're married to more than one person. So it caused a lot of issues. But you could marry someone for love. In fact, one of the Paston girls did this. I can't remember. I think it's one of the Margarets. One of the Pastons married for love, and it was to somebody who was below her station, and the churchman tried to annul it. I think Ruth talks about this in that podcast episode as well. And they couldn't, because once you've said the words, you are married. So you could marry for love in that you didn't have to have a complicated contract or a priest or rings or anything like that, which means that it's pretty easy for people to marry for love if they were willing to deal with the consequences. Now, one of the things that I think points to the fact that people did marry for love is the charivari tradition. And that is something that, again, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right because I've only ever read it, but this tradition was something that happened, especially in England, where if the community was upset at a marriage that had happened, they would make noise outside of the married couple's house all night and just be general nuisances to show their disapproval for the marriage. So for people to be marrying despite what the community thinks means to me that they weren't marrying for advantage, but they were probably marrying because they liked each other or they loved each other. So marriage for peasants didn't need to be horrible. In fact, it might have had a better chance of being happy than marriage between nobles just because of the fact that they weren't nobles. So that's just something I thought was worth mentioning. Okay, so this brings me to myth number 4, which is kind of unrelated to anything, but just something that I see a lot, and that is that peasants lived in dreary, kind of dull, drab places. One of the things that COVID-19 has taught me is that when people can't go out and buy things with disposable income, they will still do their best to make things pretty inside their house. Right? I was talking to people last week and saying, you know, if you'd told me last year that we were all going to be stuck inside for a while and that we were all going to be doing something inside, I would never have guessed that the things people are doing would be making bread and painting rocks. But this is what people are doing. They're making bread, they're painting rocks. And I mean, no judgment. That's awesome. If that's your thing, do it. But it shows me that humans, we love things that are pretty. We love to collect things that are pretty. How many times have you taken a kid out and they've come home with their pockets full of rocks just because they're pretty? So I think we can't assume that a peasant's household would be ugly or drab just because they didn't have a lot of money. We like to make art as human beings, and I think you'd see that in a peasant house as well. So everybody has a talent. If COVID-19 has taught me nothing else, is that everybody has a talent. And if you had one that was for decor, then you'd probably use it, right? Crafting, carving, painting, making stuff out of clay, weaving baskets, that kind of stuff you could do. And if you couldn't do those things, you could probably trade for those things. Like, I can't carve a beautiful spoon, but I can make you an amazing, I don't know, dessert. And trade that for this spoon. And you could do that. So just because people had not a lot of disposable income doesn't mean that their places were ugly. Also, if you're a peasant, you may not have a lot of use for cash unless you were saving up to buy your own place, in which case you might collect a lot of cash and then buy your own place. It was something that could happen. But if you didn't have a lot of use for cash or you didn't think you'd be able to save it up, you could buy something nice for your house. And this is something that not only peasants, but nobles did as well. You'd buy something nice like silver plates or a coconut cup or something that's nice, it's useful, but you could also trade it if you needed to, or you could sell it if you needed to get ready cash. So instead of keeping cash around, people would invest it in things for their homes. So if they had disposable income, they could use it on pretty things too. There's also one more thing to mention here, and that is just the fact that people were eating would result in things that they could use to make pretty decorations, right? If you're eating animals, it means that you're gonna have bone, horn, leather, fur, shells, and feathers. And all of these things could be used for the most practical purposes first, but after that, they could be used for decoration, for art, for something to make your place look pretty. So a lot of the decorations that you'd probably find in a peasant home would be modest. Right? You wouldn't have gold thread, but they would probably have places that were as nice as they could make them. And so I don't think we should assume that a peasant house was like a jail cell. I think people even decorate their jail cells, right? So we shouldn't assume that a peasant home was completely ugly and drab. We should imagine that, like us, they probably made it as much of a home as they possibly could using the materials that they had. Okay, so I ranted a bit at the beginning, and I'm probably going to rant here at the end, because the last thing that I want to mention here is a myth that people have, that people in the Middle Ages, especially peasants, they didn't love their children because their children died all the time. So they kept themselves from loving their children, treated them like little adults if they were around, and decided they wouldn't love them until they were older and past the immediate danger of toddlerhood or infancy. So the thing I want to ask you is, have you ever tried to stop yourself from loving someone, especially a child? Like, have you ever tried to stop yourself from loving someone? Because I don't know about you, but I find that very, very difficult to do. Try and stop yourself. You can give yourself all sorts of rational reasons, like the odds of them living through this year are not very great, for example. But we are human beings. Our offspring require us to take care of them for years and years and years and years. We are built to love our children. So there is no reason, I think, to believe that people in the Middle Ages didn't love their children. The reason that people cite most often for why people might not have loved their children in the Middle Ages is the fact that babies died a lot. So let's address this. And I do want to say, if you're feeling raw right now, emotionally raw, maybe skip this. Maybe skip the next 2 or 3 minutes, because I do want to talk about what happened when babies died, because I do think that tells us a lot about medieval society. All right. So according to the church fathers, and I think it was St. Augustine that really set this down, unbaptized babies who died were meant, they went to hell, according to the dogma at the time. And people didn't believe this because they wanted to. In fact, they did not like this, but it was the only way that theology made sense, because you had to be baptized, you had to accept Jesus in order to be saved. So an unbaptized child could not be saved. It just wasn't possible, theologically speaking. So if people didn't love their children, this wouldn't matter to them, right? It wouldn't matter at all. If their children died and they went to hell, it wouldn't matter at all. What we see is actually the opposite. Now, here's something that is pretty gross. Because the fact that an unbaptized child was not a Christian, technically, and Nicholas Orme gets at this in his book on medieval childhood, a mother who died with the infant still in utero should have that infant, the fetus, removed from her before she was buried in the churchyard and it was buried outside. In practice, this never happened. Why? Because people couldn't do it. They couldn't take this baby out. They needed to bury the mother in the churchyard. They needed to bury the child in the churchyard as well. So even though technically, and according to the dogma at the time, the way to save people's souls was to do this, they would not do it. Medieval people would not do it. In fact, the Pope allowed anybody to baptize a child in distress, a baby that was being born that was in distress. They didn't think it was going to survive. The Pope allowed anyone to baptize this child. And this is still the same case today. You can baptize a child if you need to, if they're in distress. It doesn't matter if you're a priest or not. And this was to save these children's souls. So obviously they cared about them. Midwives who were delivering and delivered a stillborn would pretend that the baby was alive long enough that they could baptize it. And they would tell people that the baby died after baptism. They made sure that this baby was saved as best they could. And we know this because there were some priests who said this is a bad idea. We know that parents snuck into graveyards, churchyards, to bury their children next to the church if they could, so that their baby could be saved, even though they were unbaptized. And this is, again, something that would put your soul in danger to do this. They did it anyway because they needed to give their children the chance to reach heaven. Parents also went to specific churches to ask for their children to be brought back to life. They asked for these miracles in certain places where they believed this would happen. So obviously people cared enough about their children, their babies, that they asked for them to still live. To me, these are huge, huge examples of how much people love their children. And really, they get to me every time. I was writing a sentence about this in Life in Medieval Europe, and it made me cry every time, every single time I wrote about it. Okay, so the children who survived. The children who survived were carried with their parents into the fields if they had to be. They were left in cradles with babysitters if they had to be. And the cradles often had straps so that if they got knocked over by a dog or a pig or another kid, the babies wouldn't fall out. They were left as safe as they possibly could be. Parents were encouraged to bathe their babies, to let them play and splash in the bathwater, which is kind of a really nice thing. When the children got older, they were expected to help out as part of the family, and hopefully all of our children these days are expected to help out as part of the family. But they were also given toys, and they were expected to play. And this is another nugget that I put in Life in Medieval Europe. Gerald of Wales was talking about his brothers built sand castles, and he built sand monasteries, which I think is super adorable. So we know that they were playing as well. We know that parents were encouraged to go to their children when their children were crying. They were encouraged to kind of troubleshoot and see what was wrong with them and soothe them. As the children got older, parents tried to arrange good marriages for them. And often, if a woman found herself in a bad marriage, she would go back to her parents. That's who she would run to. She wouldn't run necessarily to a convent for refuge. She would run back to her parents. Now we know, especially if you are in isolation with small children right now, you know how hard it can be to try and get your work done with children around. So it was helpful if you had an elder close by. They couldn't do a lot of the manual labor anymore. They could watch your children for you. If you had older children, they could watch the children for you. But these children were cared for at all times as much as possible. Sometimes it was difficult because just the sheer amount of work that a peasant had to do just to survive meant that sometimes you would have to leave your child in a cradle for a little while you went and did your stuff. But we know that they did love their children completely, and that they mourned them if they died, that they took care of them as best they could while they were alive. And it didn't matter how much mortality there was, child mortality there was, it didn't stop people from loving their children. I really have to emphasize this one as well, because I do see it everywhere. It's kind of beyond my comprehension. So I think that parenting in the Middle Ages would have been really, really difficult, so much more difficult than it is for us right now. I mean, the sheer difficulty of peasants being able to bathe and do their laundry, I mean, and then infants on top of that, and several in the household, like it would have been a huge amount of work. And for me, perhaps that is the best indication that they loved their children. These children were a whole lot of work, and they took care of them anyway. So peasants loved their children. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. They definitely loved their children. Okay, is that enough ranting for one day? Peter, in a second, is going to have really exciting news for you about peasants. But I wanted to talk just a little bit about peasants today, because they are the backbone of medieval society. And this kind of just skips along the top, but there's some of the things that I think you see most common when you see medieval peasants showing up in the media, in movies and books. And hopefully this gives you a better idea of what life is like for medieval peasants.
Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on, Peter?
Hi, Danielle. We're actually bringing in a few new writers to join the website in the next couple of weeks. So we took a poll of our Patreon members, and the couple that they chose were about peasants in the Middle Ages and Eastern Europe in the Middle Ages. So we're right now looking for columnists on that, and another one is on China in the Middle Ages. So we're hoping by the end of the month have three new voices added to the website. So I'm pretty excited about that.
So if people are listening and they are specialists in these things, should they send you an email?
Yes, yes. If you can, in the next few days, you can do it at medievalist.net@gmail.com and let me know your background and what you'd like to write about in these kind of fields. So,
what else is going on?
On the website right now, you can read pieces about the end of the world as it was foreseen in 15th century Germany, and that involves a castle hanging by a thread.
Like a literal thread?
Yes, like a little thread. So you can read about dancing in medieval manuscripts and novels about the Arthurian world.
Oh, so, that sounds great.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun stuff this week.
That's awesome. Anything else for us, Peter?
that is enough. That's enough for but
All right. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Thank you to all of the patrons on Patreon.com who voted on what the new series for Medievalist.net are going to be, and to keep this podcast going with your generosity. In case you haven't heard, there's even more good stuff for patrons these days, as we've now partnered with the Medieval Magazine, a digital magazine for all things medieval. If you love the podcast, why not grab yourself a subscription to the Medieval Magazine or Medieval Warfare Magazine, or even both at the same time? Your support is the fuel for this particular fire, and it is most appreciated. Check out all the details at patreon.com/medievalists. For all the best medieval content, including the new series coming soon, follow medievalists.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Sabalski, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books, including Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, on Amazon or through your local bookstore. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening. Have yourself an awesome day.